Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in central Iowa. I am Ursula Rudenberg, your host for this hour. Thank you for joining us to listen. After a beautiful and sunny weekend, it looks like April. Look forward to a rainy week with chances of rain starting today and increasing until it's pretty certain that by Wednesday it will be a rainy day and temperatures will stay in the 70s or high 60s during the days and 50s at night. We should start to see the sun again by late Thursday and Friday, but days will have cooled it down a bit to be in the 60s. Saturday should be a sunny day with chances of rain on Sunday with temperatures in the low 60s. Sounds like April. Now here's Dennis Hart with a summary of Iowa news from this past week.
The coronavirus, that fatal accident involving Iowa State University Crew Club members, and what went on in the state legislature all made big news in Iowa last week. The death toll from the virus went up in the state last week, exceeding 5,800 by yesterday. And the total number of people infected by it also went up to more than 381,000 in Iowa by yesterday. Among those infected, another person associated with the state House of Representatives. Earlier this year, several people associated with the House were reported to have the virus. And last Monday, the Iowa Senate confirmed a case of the coronavirus there. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds signed a new public health disaster proclamation this past Friday, extending the state's coronavirus protocols for another 30 days. It urges residents, businesses, and organizations to take reasonable public health measures. This coming after Iowa's 7-day rate of positive coronavirus tests increased 18% compared to the week earlier. That uptick coincides with continuing trends across the nation. The governor said that state officials are monitoring the recent uptick in Iowa's virus cases, but that they do not believe the state is heading down what the governor called a concerning path of virus activity. But the governor stressed the importance of Iowans continuing to take coronavirus precautions and that residents get vaccinated as soon as possible. Vaccine availability in Iowa will open today to everyone aged 16 and older. Some counties have already opened vaccines to all. Doctors say until a critical mass of vaccination is reached, people should continue to wear masks, avoid large gatherings, and wash their hands often. Meanwhile, there was word that one of the state lawmakers who had earlier tested positive for the virus, Representative Amy Nielsen of North Liberty, said she is still having trouble breathing, often feels lightheaded, and occasionally still has what she calls horrible headaches. She tested positive at the end of January, more than 2 months ago. There was also word last week that possibly because of the coronavirus pandemic, public school enrollment in Iowa has gone down for the first time in a decade. About 6,000 fewer students enrolled statewide this year compared to last, and there's no way to figure out where all of them went. Meanwhile, the Des Moines Public School District plans to cut more than $14 million from its budget for the next school year because of an enrollment decline thought to have been brought about by the coronavirus. Those cuts include about $4 million in staffing, another $4 million from health benefits, $2 million from retirement incentives, and another $1.5 million from activities that will be discontinued, including a school conference. Still in Des Moines, the city's public library resumed full-day in-person services last Monday at all six of its locations. Most of the library services had been shut down for the past year because of the coronavirus. Visitors over the age of two will be required to wear masks, and social distancing will be required. And in Ankeny, public facilities reopened last Thursday after being closed for more than a year by the coronavirus. In Hamilton County last week, divers recovered the bodies of two members of the Iowa State University Crew Club who had drowned during an outing at Little Wall Lake last Sunday. Three other Crew Club members were rescued. The boat they were in had capsized. The fatal victims were identified as 20-year-old Yaakov Ben David, a sophomore accounting major from Washington, D.C., and 19-year-old Derek Nani, a freshman chemistry major from Normal, Illinois. In the wake of that fatal incident, there was word that ISU's crew club members had brought safety concerns to the university's Recreation Services Department in February of last year. In a letter written to that department, club members said, in their words, it wouldn't take much for someone to get seriously hurt. That letter outlined three actions that should be taken: building a dock, repairing or buying a new launch or coach boat, and instituting a mandatory swim test for team members. The swim test was implemented by the crew club. Last Thursday, the university said that the sport's national governing body, the United States Rowing Association, will conduct an investigation into what happened at Little Wall Lake. And the crew club said it will not practice, compete, or hold other activities until that investigation is complete. In Davenport last week, Police confirmed that human remains discovered by fishermen in a wooded area north of DeWitt were those of 10-year-old Breasia Terrell. She had been reported missing after spending the night with her half-brother at the apartment of his father, Henry Earl Dinkins of Davenport. The 48-year-old Dinkins is in custody on sex offender registration violations not related to Terrell's disappearance and death. He has been named a person of interest in the case, but has not been identified as a suspect. Meanwhile, two inmates at the Anamosa State Penitentiary were charged with first-degree murder in connection with the killings of a correctional officer and a nurse in the prison infirmary, and the union representing prison workers released a letter it had sent to state lawmakers pushing for action to protect employee safety. In the world of politics last week, Iowa Democrat Rita Hart withdrew her challenge to Republican U.S. Representative Marionette Miller Meeks' election to the state's 2nd congressional district. Hart had previously asked the U.S. House to review the outcome of the November election, which had decided in Meeks' favor by 6 votes out of about 400,000 votes that were cast. That was the tightest margin of any U.S. election since 1974. Also last week, Governor Reynolds signed into law a bill that ends the requirement that Iowans must get a permit to buy and carry a gun. In the state legislature last week, a key deadline came and went on Friday. That deadline is the second so-called funnel, meaning bills must pass through one legislative chamber and through a full committee in the other chamber to move forward. Among the bills that are still alive, the abortion constitutional amendment that would say the Iowa Constitution does not provide the right to an abortion, a bill to grant qualified immunity for law enforcement officers, a bill to create a new method of forming charter schools, a bill that would ban the teaching of divisive concepts at Iowa public schools and universities, a bill that would increase penalties for drivers who unintentionally cause a death or serious injury while speeding, a bill to use tax credits to help developers lower the cost of financing affordable housing construction, and proposals to amend the state's decades-old bottle bill. Again, these bills are still alive in the state legislature. Among the bills that did not survive the funnel, one that would have penalized cities and counties for defunding police, a constitutional amendment that would have automatically restored felon voting rights, a bill that would have eliminated tenure at Iowa's public universities, bills designed to penalize tech companies like Facebook and Twitter for restricting what people can say online, a bill that would have let Iowa adults get birth control pills at pharmacies without receiving a prescription at a clinic first, a bill that would have required Iowa doctors to provide women seeking abortions information about reversing the pill's effects, a bill that would have prohibited Iowa employers from requiring employees to be vaccinated against the coronavirus, bills that would have provided protections to mobile home park residents, and a bill that would have prohibited cities from using traffic cameras. Again, those bills are dead. Laura Bellin and I will be here tonight at 7 on KHOI's Capital Week to analyze what happened in the legislature. In other news last week, word that Iowans will not have to file their state income taxes until June 1st. And many will not have to pay taxes on unemployment insurance benefits they received last year. Iowa Department of Revenue Director Craig Paulson signed an order that pushes the tax filing deadline to the beginning of June. The state delay comes after the Federal Internal Revenue Service pushed back the deadline for filing federal income tax returns to May 17th. Also last week, a Washington State rancher admitted he defrauded Tyson Foods and other companies of nearly $250 million paid for cattle that never existed. Cody Easterday pleaded guilty in federal court to wire fraud and faces up to 10 years in prison. He's agreed to repay more than $244 million. And last week, word that Iowa grocers lost a lawsuit in district court that environmental groups worried would gut the state's bottle bill. It's a decision that could leave the fate of the more than 40-year-old law in the hands of the state legislature. There was also word that University of Iowa President Bruce Harreld will forfeit more than $2 million by retiring before his contract expires in 2023. Last October, Harreld announced he planned to retire from his $590,000-a-year job, but said he would be willing to stay on until 2023, until a new president was chosen, in order to avoid any interim leadership. But the State Board of Regents has decided to appoint an interim president, and the search for Harreld's permanent replacement is going much faster than anticipated. In the world of sports last week, word that Ames had joined 9 other non-urban schools in separating from suburban schools and forming their own more competitive athletic conference. The other schools include 5 in Des Moines, East, Hoover, Lincoln, North, and Roosevelt, as well as Fort Dodge, Marshalltown, Mason City, and Ottumwa. They all will leave the Central Iowa Metropolitan League starting in the 2022-2023 academic year. And one more note from the sports world, word that the couple who owns the world's largest truck stop in eastern Iowa has donated $10 million to the University of Iowa football program and other athletic projects. And part of Will and Renee Moon's donation will fund the head football coaching position forever. Renee Moon said they're doing this because they enjoy the Hawkeye football program. And that is your summary of quite a week of news from all around Iowa. I'm Dennis Hart, taking my leave now, but planning to come right back here tonight live at 7 on KHOI's Capital Week, when Laura Bell and I will talk about what took place in the state legislature last week and what it means for all of us. Then I'll return Friday morning at 7, when I'll report on what makes news in Ames. Have a great week.
April by Deep Purple, and this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host, Ursula Rudenberg. Thanks for listening, and thank you to Dennis Hart for the summary of the Iowa news. Last week, Dennis sat down with Ames School District Superintendent Jenny Risner to take stock. Dennis interviewed Superintendent Risner last fall at the onset of the school year with all of its daunting unknowns and challenges. And it's almost hard to believe that we're now at the other end of that year and that we're all still standing, more or less. So let's listen in. It's quite a story.
Superintendent, let's talk with something that is positive. At least I hope it's positive. How is construction on the new high school going?
Oh, yes. Great. Very positive conversation. It's basically on schedule. We're on schedule and on budget. So that's a great place to be. We've had a few challenges, you know, just with COVID and the winter storms and the cold weather, but there was a little bit of a delay in some of the delivery, material delivery because of COVID. And of course, the weather caused some outdoor activity to slow down a little bit, but the construction team has been able to adapt And the overall project is definitely looking good. So we're on schedule.
What's the timetable for completion?
Yes. So we should be ready to go. Building will be ready to begin class in the fall of 2020. The building will be substantially completed May of 2022. It'll be substantially completed. It'll allow that beginning in May. It'll allow us to do some of the final touch-ups. And then we'll begin the delivery of furniture and all the prep that goes into moving into a new building. So that'll happen in May and June. And then, you know, we'll be ready to go fall of 2022.
I know this is going to be one of those questions that I'm teeing up the ball for you, but how is this new school going to be an improvement over the existing Ames High School?
Yes. You know, the existing Ames High has had, I believe I heard at one time, somewhere around 30 additions of some sort. So additions and modifications. If you walk through there, there's lots of strange nooks and crannies and tons of doors. So the new building will allow for us to serve our current enrollment, as well as the possibility for future enrollment increases. And then from a safety standpoint, there'll be reduced entry points. And then the layout is really nice for supervision. There's a significant reduction in free access throughout the building. And so there, it'll be a nice building for supervision. And then, of course, there's going to be system updates. So we'll have the up-to-date HVAC systems, the power and technology that goes with that, and then the efficiency of the LED lighting and geothermal system and a very building automation system will be really high tech. So, you know, it's moving us into a much more up-to-date building that's better with security and the size.
Once we get into the new Ames High School, what happens to the old one?
Yes. In the summer of 2022, we'll begin to remove all of the remaining furniture and fixtures and the remaining asbestos to prepare the building for demolition. And then the demolition is scheduled to be completed over the fall and winter of 2022 and 2023. And so in the spring of 2023, once we have it, the demolition complete, then we'll start the site fill and the grading and the placement of practice fields. And then the north staff parking lot is also planned.
So all of this has been a bright spot in what's been a really difficult year.
That's for sure. Very challenging year.
Let's talk about it. You have had so many challenges in this. We can only call this a coronavirus-laced year.
Yes.
You started all online, then in fits and starts moved on, and there were fits and there were starts. Where is the district right now in terms of in-class sessions and online sessions?
Yes, absolutely. So we are currently fully in person with the remote option. So families can choose to be fully in person or they can choose to be fully remote. So both of those options are in place and it's gone really well.
Talk about the differential, though, in terms of learning between students who have remained online and been online all year and those who are back in classrooms. I know when we talked earlier, you were worried about the differential, the learning problems there.
Right. Yes. The hybrid model created a lot of challenges for us in terms of parents being able to provide the time necessary to help their children when they were in that remote setting. So families that have been able to choose remote have been able to do so and set up a system. But when we were forced into that model where families also had to do the in-person and on-site, for many families, it just didn't work. So currently, we have about 31% of our students who are fully remote, and that's going very well. Again, those are parents who have been able to make the necessary changes within the family structure to provide that support for students. And so about 35% of our secondary students are remote and about 26% of our elementary students. And so, you know, we've seen in terms of grade disparity, we've done a lot of work to get students kind of some of those necessary skills that maybe they were lacking that they hadn't gotten at the end of last year. And so we were able to pick that back up. And when you look at our grade disparity, there is not a lot of significant difference between students' grades on site and online. So that's been good.
You indicated a bit ago to a board meeting that you're going to continue, I believe, next year with an online option. Talk about that.
Right. We got a lot of feedback from our families who were in that online setting that it was working really well. And some of the struggles that maybe their students had had, that this was a better environment for them. So we want in Ames, we want to give every student the best educational opportunity that we can possibly provide. And that sometimes looks like individualizing. And so for those students that have had a lot of success in the remote campus and want to remain in that, we wanted to be able to offer that option for them. So we will continue next year to do K through 12 online options for students. And we're not through with all of the planning around it. And of course, that's dependent on having enough students who access it. But we don't believe that's going to be an issue based on our initial outreach to parents. And so not having all of the details yet in that program structure, but we do have a committee that's working through that, both at secondary and at elementary level. And they're putting out some great work.
Well, now, could this possibly become a permanent part of the scene, a permanent online component here?
It definitely could. I think one thing the pandemic's given us is the ability to really to create programs that are meeting our kids' needs in different ways than we have before. And so we don't want to lose the good that has come out of COVID and the good that it's forced within our educational system. And so we do see this as something that may be an option for students and parents that they want to have remain.
How is this working out in terms of staffing? Are the same teachers who are teaching in class also teaching at the same time at home?
Great question. So for our elementary students, no, we have teachers who are 100% remote. All of their students are actually remote campus students. At secondary, grades 6 through 12, it's a little bit more of a combo. We have some that are completely remote, but I'd say the majority are teaching both remote and in person, and that is difficult. We are trying to make sure they get a period where they teach just remote. And so working through the scheduling of that for next year and how that might look is really something we want to make a top priority to try to limit that, you know, the overburdening of teachers.
Well, how is this working? Are teachers who are in class, are they wearing some sort of camera that is broadcasting to the house for most of those periods? In other words, the kids at home are seeing it simultaneously with the kids in class?
Yeah, again, some are seeing it in real time live, and then others have their teacher teaching remotely with no other kids in the class. And then some teachers also do recorded lessons that they post, and then they have meeting time with students.
This has to have put a tremendous burden on your teaching staff to accommodate this. I'll ask you how difficult that was. And then as a secondary question, have some teachers indicated they'd really rather be teaching fully online as we go forward?
Definitely. Let me talk first about the burden. And I just want to commend and never lose sight of the incredible amount of work that has been placed on our educators through COVID. We have seen people just really rise and take on that, but it's not sustainable, and we know that. And so I can't say enough about our teaching staff. We just have a phenomenal staff, and they really work hard. And so that has been something that has been on my mind daily since we got into this in March. And then in terms of teachers indicating that they wanted to teach remote, we sure have. We've had some teachers reach out to us and say they would love to teach fully remote. We've had others reach out and say, I don't want to teach remote. I want to be in person with students. And we've had some that have indicated both. Like, I like teaching the combination. And so I'd be really willing and excited to try that. So we've really had the whole spectrum.
Wow. Well, in terms of the students who are in school, in classes, what have you done and what are you doing to keep them safe and healthy away from the coronavirus?
Again, I really commend our staff and our district leaders on the mitigation strategies that they've put in place. Our district has really done a phenomenal job of mitigation, and we've seen that. And as a result, we've been able to be fully in person and really have very limited exposure for students. So we continue to have all of our students and staff wear masks and physically distance to the greatest extent possible. We have lunch sectioned off in ways that allow for some social distancing, and we keep track of where students are so that if there is an exposure that happens during lunch, we know what students that would have happened with. And then we continue to cohort our elementary students. We clean and disinfect really well, and so we follow those CDC guidelines with that. And then we continue to do, like I mentioned, the contact tracing for any positive case within the school environment. And we've really done a great job of that. I think another exciting thing is that we've been able to offer vaccination clinics to all of our staff and then others who are in contact with our students. So that may look like bus drivers, food service workers, tutors, coaches, our substitute teachers. So we've been able to, we estimate that we have over 75% of our staff who will be vaccinated through one of our clinics. And then, you know, having staff really protects our students, having our staff vaccinated. So, and then, you know, we have adapted to the CDC guidelines for schools in the transition period to determine how to safely offer some of those spring events that we know are important to our students, graduation, baccalaureate, things like that. So we're really working hard on taking those CDC guidelines for schools and helping to be able to establish some guidance around how we offer some of those activities again.
What about that 25% of staff that has not been vaccinated? Are they declining the opportunity to get the vaccine?
Yes, I think that some have received the vaccine somewhere else. So they maybe got it on their own through a different provider. And then we have some that have opted out of the vaccine. But for the most part, that 75% is really who's been vaccinated through us. And then we'll be able to have a better estimate on total number of staff vaccinated as time goes on.
Now, you cannot require teachers and staff to be vaccinated, can you?
Not at this time, no.
You have had some students, as I've been following in the local media, including KHOI, which I've been reporting on. You've had some students contracted. You've had some teachers contracted. What's been, in terms of the percentage, do you have a percentage of teachers and students who might have contracted it?
You know, I don't. That's a great question. And I know it's very low in terms of contracted from the educational environment, from school. In terms of how many of our staff and students have had COVID, but it's not school related, I don't have that information.
What about during physical education classes? How have you kept kids safe there?
We were having kids do some more individualized fitness programs, leave masks on, you know, distance. I know that whenever there's an option to go outside, we're really encouraging our PE teachers to take those students outside.
All right. For those who have just tuned in, where have you been? This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm Dennis Hart, talking with Ames School District Superintendent Jenny Reisner about all that's been going on in this crazy coronavirus-laced school year. There's been a lot of it. There have been some other issues as well, though, and we should talk about those. One of the more controversial ones, you know where I'm going on this, Black History Month. The district got involved with focused on learning about Black issues in the community. Oh, it reacted, some in favor, some not. And a State House committee even summoned you and others to talk about what happened. So, Superintendent, please talk about what happened.
You bet. So we have been engaged for about 3 years in our equity work. And so we call it our critical consciousness work. We've been heavily engaged in it. And really, equity is at the heartbeat of our school. And so, you know, we have been planning the ultimate goal throughout the 3 years is to begin to implement this in the classroom. So we have had lots and lots of teachers and other staff member who have been trained, had this deep level of training. And then we've had those individuals go back to their buildings and they've created equity teams. And so these teams then have been planning for how we begin to implement these practices within our classrooms. And so the Black History Month, what happened to just be the time that we first rolled out, and we rolled it out using this school week of action around BLM, school week of action. It's not affiliated with the BLM movement. However, the title being the same automatically creates some of that. But really what the whole week is about love and acceptance and creating a safe space for all of our students and really embracing diversity and acceptance. And so, you know, in hindsight, we did some things really well, and we did some things that I think we can improve on in terms of communication that could have been done better in a way that was maybe gave more time for parents to understand. I think for the majority of our teachers, they're engaged in this work on a daily basis, and as we are, but then for parents, this being their first exposure to it, I think we could have given them less information in terms of, we posted the whole broad set of resources. And in looking back, what might have been better was to post just what we were using. So this is what is being used, let's say at Meeker for first grade, at Meeker for second grade. And I think that would have really helped parents understand. There were a couple topics that I think created the most concern, and that was around queer and transgender affirmation. So basically accepting that individuals can choose and they still deserve to have a safe space and a place in our school where they feel accepted. And the other one was around the disruption of the nuclear family. And so that language kind of got pulled out of it. But what that principle was really about was identifying and recognizing and again, accepting that families look different. So it might be a family where they have fostered kids. It might be a family where they only have a mom. It might be a family where they have two moms or two dads, but really embracing that the structure may look different for every family. And we really welcome all families into our schools. So I think the message around those could have been delivered in a way that parents understood it more rather than just reading the titles. So we want to make sure that we recognize and listen to that feedback from parents.
Did the State House committee reaction surprise you? They called you up essentially for a verbal spanking. Did that surprise you?
You know, I don't know that we would say, I think when you look at some of the bills that have been introduced and the kind of the attitude of that House Oversight Committee, I'm not surprised that this was something they wanted to bring us forward and talk to us about. I'm disappointed. It's just really disappointing to be an educational leader and have the message be sent that we really don't value all individuals. And I think that message was sent loud and clear. And so, you know, it's unfortunate. It's something that, you know, just causes me as a leader great, great concern for the future of Iowa and just feel really disappointed. But we will continue to do the work that we're doing and continue to look at how we create safe spaces for all of our students and our parents.
Are you planning to do this again next year?
We are. And this isn't something that really is a one and done. This is something, you know, that we want to have embedded in our curriculum, embedded in our classes, that that it's just really about, you know, being a kind human, being a human who values others and appreciates others' opinions as well. So, yes.
How do you feel about the way the state legislature and the governor have handled various educational issues this past year? The governor pushing so hard to get students back into classrooms, even when the pandemic was raging. The legislature taking certain steps, sending messages. They've certainly sent messages to the state university system by threatening to ban tenure. Yep. They're sending messages. How do you feel about this?
It is so incredibly disappointing and concerning. I think that as a state, we should be very concerned with the direction that they are trying to take education. It's certainly taking us back years and years and years to times that were not good for anybody. And so, you know, it is concerning. There's been a very loud and clear message sent, I think, to educators that we are not going to support all viewpoints and taking some local control away. When you talk about being mandated to come back during COVID, that was scary. That was scary for parents. That was scary for school districts. That's a lot of burden to place on school leaders. We have an obligation to keep our students safe. And so being required to come back in times that were not safe was concerning. And then as you look across the nation, you know, you'll find that many, many, many districts are just now coming into a hybrid model. When I talk to my colleagues across the nation, it's really mind-blowing to hear the differences. But I think, you know, Ames, we have been able to come back and we have been able to keep students safe, but that is partially because we've had so many students who have been in remote campus that it's allowed for additional space within our classrooms.
I want to go over a couple of quick issues. One of them is school resource officers. There is certainly a controversy in the district right now that SROs have had a disproportionate number of interactions with Black or minority students compared to white students. Briefly talk about how the SRO program works and where we go from here.
You bet. So the SRO program is a national program, and it's all about placing a law enforcement officer in schools or officers. They're involved in a variety of functions, and really the overarching theme is that they want to enhance the relationship between the school community and the law enforcement. And so I think that we have seen a disparity in the data, and that is what's caused this concern. But really, the law officer that's in the school, they do a variety of things, which could be violence diffusion. It could be safety programs. They could be, you know, working on drug and alcohol prevention, crime prevention. And so the SRO really takes a personal interest in our students and their activities. And so they're that resource for teachers, parents, and students. But I don't want to diminish the research behind that we had one of our, Dr. Bankin, who is our equity committee lead. The research behind SROs in schools is not positive. And so I think as a district who's really committed to equity, that's where we have to begin looking. Okay, so if the research isn't positive, what is our local data telling us? And so that's where we began looking at our local data. And, you know, we have to do those conversations in the public. And so as we're sorting through that, you get public input because of the structure of school districts and looking at and researching that data all is in the public.
One other issue before I ask my last question, and this is the district has just voted to leave the Central Iowa Metropolitan Athletic Conference and join 9 other schools in forming a whole new conference, including 5 Des Moines schools, and we have Mason City, Ottumwa, Marshalltown, and Fort Dodge. Briefly, why? Why is Ames doing this?
Historically, there has been a decline in participation at some of the schools. Ames, too, has experienced that as those other districts, as those urban districts have grown, we have stayed pretty close to the same. And so we have a much smaller student pool to pull from, and it's created disparities in the outcomes. So the 10 schools that you mentioned, we're making an effort to try and rebuild our programs and the participation and give students kind of the same demographic makeup to play against so that it levels the playing field. So that's overall, I think it's really about what's best for students, wanting to ensure that we provide programs that students are able to experience success in.
And this is going to happen not this year, but after this
right.
year.
Correct.
Okay. And now I want to ask you a question I asked you 6 months ago when we last talked about how difficult this school year has been for you professionally and personally. I'd like you to address that if you would.
Yeah, thank you. I think that professionally, I probably said this last time, but I don't remember. There has really never been a more difficult time to be a school superintendent. You know, we're faced with making educational decisions, medical health decisions, mental health, athletics, and then all the while really ensuring that we have mitigation efforts that are meeting our community and needs. And really, with our country and seeing the turmoil that is going on, the racial divide, that seeps into the schools. And so we have to be very mindful. It is a stressful time in our country, and that certainly is felt for me professionally. I can't say, you know, I can't say that I've ever felt a more difficult time in my career.
And you told me back then it was also having an impact on you personally.
It does. You know, I think stress takes a toll. It's a very lonely position. That's just in general. Superintendent positions are, those are lonely positions. And so you always think that while most people are very thoughtful and respectful, there are times when, you know, the attacks become hurtful and they're of a personal nature, and they're hurtful both to me and to my kids and to my family. And so working through that, you know, is never easy. And there always seems to be a thought that there's hidden agendas. And I can certainly say there's not hidden agendas, but I also feel really valued in this community and appreciated and well supported. So, you know, while you have that stress that takes its toll, and this being a really incredibly stressful period of time, you always look at all that support and kindness that the community has. And this is a really great community for that. I also say one other thing quick professionally, there's also never been a more exciting time in education, because we, for the first time, are forced to look at the inequities and forced to look at how we really engage and reach all learners. And that's a pretty exciting time in education.
Are you looking forward to coming back next year?
Absolutely. Yes, definitely.
So we have that on the record.
Yes. I love Ames. I love our community. I love our school district, our staff. We just have amazing people here. I'm blessed.
Well, we are too. I want to thank you so much, Superintendent Jenny Reisner, for being with me again today. It's been our pleasure.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
I'm going to be the first to interview you when school district starts next year. I want to be the first to talk to you.
You got it. You got it. I'm so hopeful. It's just going to be a smooth start. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye, guys.
I am alone, I am searching. hungering for answers in my time. I am balanced at the brink of wisdom. I'm impatient to receive a sign. I move forward with my senses open. Imperfection, it be my crime. In humility, I will listen. We're all swimming to the other side. We are living in the great big dipper. We are washed by the very same rain. We are swimming in the stream together, some in power and some in pain. We can worship this ground we walk on, cherishing the beings that we live beside. Loving spirits will live forever. We're all swimming to the other side. On this journey through thoughts and feelings, binding intuition, my head, my heart, I am gathering the tools together. I'm preparing to do my part. All of those who have come before me, band together and be my guide. Loving lessons that I will follow. We're all swimming to the other side. We are living beneath the great big dipper. We are washed by the very same rain. We are swimming in the stream together, some in power and some in vain. We can worship this ground we walk on, cherishing the beings that we live beside. Loving spirits will live forever. We're all swimming to the other side.
Swimming to the Other Side by Emma's Revolution. To honor the heavy lifting done this past year by the Ames school system, and thank you to Superintendent Jenny Risner and KHOI's Dennis Hart for that conversation, bringing us up to date in this journey through unusual times. And I think unusual is a mild term for what we're talking about, shall we say, difficult and frightening and strenuous. Let's dedicate the song, too, to all of the vaccination clinics that are getting the job done in Iowa.
All of the gifts we've been given to share have been with us since life's beginning, and we never noticed they were there. We can balance at the brink of wisdom, never recognizing that we've arrived. Loving spirits will live together. We're all swimming to the other side. We are living in the great big dipper. We are washed by the very same rain. We are swimming in the stream together, some in power and some in pain. We can worship this ground we walk on, cherishing the beings that we live beside. Loving spirits will live forever. We're all swimming to the other side. Loving spirits will live forever. We're all swimming to the other side.
Earth Day is coming around again on April 22nd. This is an annual international event in support for environmental protection, which originated in the United States in 1970. I celebrated my first Earth Day by riding my horse onto Central Campus. I remember it well. Last year, it was estimated that 1 billion people in more than 193 countries celebrated Earth Day's 50th anniversary. Wow. Fun fact, the landmark Paris Agreement was signed by the United States, China, and some 120 other countries on Earth Day in 2016. This signing enforced the historic climate protection treaty adopted by 195 countries at the 2015 United Nations Climate Change Conference in Paris. KHOI will celebrate 2021 Earth Day here on Local Talk on April 22nd, which is a Wednesday, and then on the following Saturday, KHOI presents Earth Day Appreciation, a day-long schedule of programs about the environment. We're really looking forward to this. Join City of Ames staff for an entire day of sustainability-themed radio, along with KHOI hosts and guests. And also the ISU Sustainability Program will also be collaborating with us. Earth Day Appreciation is a collaboration of the City of Ames and KHOI Community Radio, and it will be held from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. on Saturday, April 24th, here on KHOI. You will hear about advancements being made by the City of Ames in the area of sustainability. And you'll also hear experts from around Central Iowa. You'll hear from ISU staff, professors and students, environmentalists in high schools and middle schools, and esteemed professionals working in environmentalists in our area. Here at KHOI, we're really excited about the variety of new ideas and voices coming together on this day from all ages and all sectors of our community in Central Iowa. Again, that's Earth Day Appreciation here on KHOI, Saturday, April 24th, from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Tell your friends and family, and if they are living elsewhere, remember to tell them they can go to khoifm.org to listen to us online or on their cell phone. Let's end the hour by turning back into the natural world. Let's look down at the ground we walk on to observe the humble bumblebee. Here's Patch Larbaum.
Phenology is recording nature's happenings when they occur. The first hepatica of spring or the last osprey of autumn are recorded in a journal for future reference. In today's focus on phenology are the bumblebees have returned. Got a call the other day from Paul Hellenschmidt. Let me know that he had seen a bumblebee. So I thought, what do I know about bumblebees? Well, here's what I've learned. Bumblebees are big fuzzy insects recognized by almost everyone by their robust shape and black and yellow coloration. The common species are 3/4 inch in length or more, and like honeybees, bumblebees live in a colony where the adults care for the young, the larvae, produced by the single queen. Bumblebee nests are small compared to honeybees, as each nest contains a few hundred individuals. Also, unlike honeybees, a bumblebee nest is annual and is used only 1 year and then abandoned. Bumblebees may reappear in the same area from 1 year to the next, but they do not reuse an old nest. Bumblebee colonies are usually underground in a deserted mouse or bird nest, though they are occasionally found within walls, cavities, or even in the vents of a clothes dryer on the side of your house, disappointingly. In the spring, each new queen selects a nest site and starts a new colony. She lines the cavity with dry moss or grass and then collects pollen and nectar to produce a stored food called bee bread. Her first brood of offspring, 15 to 20 members, will all be workers or daughters who take over the colony responsibilities of nest enlargement, food gathering and storage, and feeding and caring for the larvae. The queen continues to lay eggs throughout the summer. By late summer, new reproductive males and females, the kings and queens, are produced. These mate on the wing, and the fertilized females move to a hibernation site in the shelter of loose bark, hollow trees, or other dry, protected places to lie dormant through the winter. The males and workers still in the colony die with frost or the first hard freeze. If the vicinity of a bumblebee nest cannot be avoided, then leave them alone and wait for them to die in the fall as the preferred management option. Live trapping bumblebees for relocation is not practical, and covering the nest entrance does not usually solve the problem. But in the meantime, realize they're another pollinator whose numbers we cherish for the pollination work that they provide. And keep looking up. The bumblebees are with us once again. That's our phenology for today.
Thank you, Patch Larbaum. You have been listening to Local Talk here on KHOI Community Radio. Thanks for being with us this hour. Local Talk airs at 7 a.m. and remember to tune in to Capital Week on Mondays at 7 p.m. I've been your host, Ursula Rudenberg. Stay tuned for Headline News and Democracy Now! At 8 a.m. and Morning Masterpieces at 9 a.m. Our theme song, as always, has been Backtrackin' by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. During this hour, you also heard Swimming to the Other Side by Emma's Revolution and April by Deep Purple. KHOI will be raising money in May with its annual spring membership drive, and we are pleased to announce that Chad Elliott and Bo Ramsey will be at Stevens Auditorium in a concert to kick off KHOI's fundraising. We're very excited. This will be on Sunday, May 9th at 5 p.m. Safety protocols will be in place for the concert, and physical distancing and enhanced disinfecting procedures will be in place. We are so honored and excited to welcome these two great musical artists to Ames in the wonderful space of CY Stevens. We deeply appreciate their help in supporting community radio, and we're looking forward to a great concert. If by any chance you don't know who Chad Elliott is, where have you been? Sorry, just kidding, kind of. Anyway, Chad is a Midwest singer-songwriter who blends folk roots, swampy blues, and soulful writing to deliver an original Americana sound. Bo Ramsey is from Burlington, Iowa, and lives in Iowa City. He's a Grammy Award-winning guitar player, two-time Grammy-nominated producer, Iowa Rock and Roll Hall of Famer, and Iowa Blues Hall of Famer. You may recognize him through his association with artists like Lucinda Williams, Greg Brown, Kevin Gordon, Pieta Brown, and Charlie Parr. So we'll keep you posted on this concert and let you know as soon as tickets go on sale. And remember that you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful, and your support makes it possible. Thank you so much for listening, and we will see you again on the radio.
Mayor John Ayla from Ames. The deaths of Iowa State University Crew Club members Yaakov Ben David and Derek Nanny while practicing rowing at Little Wall Lake are painful and tragic. The entire Ames community extends its deepest sympathies to their families and friends. We share your sorrow at such a sudden and unexpected loss of life and are devastated by the outcome of this accident. Although I never had the pleasure of meeting either student, I have learned that Yaakov was a sophomore from Washington, D.C., majoring in accounting, and Derek was a freshman chemistry major from Normal, Illinois. They apparently both loved rowing and were enthusiastic participants in the sport. As a community, we welcome students from all over the globe to Ames to attend Iowa State University. As they learn, grow, and develop into future leaders, we hope and aspire for them to find their life's passion and place in the world. We are saddened by this unrealized potential from lives so unexpectedly cut short, and our hearts go out to their families and friends. The Ames City Council and City of Ames staff join the entire Iowa State University family and our own Ames residents in remembering Yaakov Ben David and Derek Nanny.